It's rare that sermons get to include visual aids, but this sermon will address a very queer and beautiful line in the Torah shortly, and it required a Google map. So I will refer to this perhaps later, but it was very enjoyable to prepare my sermon and print a Google map. Legends and myths and the nature of what our people and the hearers of the Torah in eras ago understood and experienced has always been a source of fascination to me. I had a conversation with the scholar Richard Elliott Friedman when he was here. When Torah and even Midrash and rabbinic stories speak of things fantastical like talking at donkeys or scenes in the Talmud where a judge with laser beam eyes like Superman destroys 30 other judges, I always was curious how those who heard it in the era of its publication experienced it. It's not clear to me that they didn't have an understanding of hyperbole as well. In fact, our sages acknowledge as much in one verse in Talmud, one line in Talmud. And so, in this parasha and elsewhere, we understand that our people, relative to other peoples of the ancient Near East, were untall, much as I felt growing up amid Irish Catholics near Boston. Jews, to an average, are not as tall as some other peoples. And to the ancient Israelites, the peoples that they would vanquish in the land were giants. They're described as such. Maybe they meant 6 inches, maybe they meant they were on average taller. I mean, there are, in various tribal areas, tribes that are uniquely tall. So we're told in this parasha about Og, who is the king of Bashan, and how we vanquished him. Of course, Deuteronomy being Moses' recapitulation of law, prose, and poetry prior to his death. So we're told of this space of Og, who had a iron or metal bedstead, and it was enormously large. It was out of proportion. It was a California king. And it is preserved in some way in a museum. They talk about this there. I'm reminded, like with the Omer of the Mana, of the kilogram ingot in Paris. You know, these referent measures that are preserved, and for us, as not just as memory of how to recreate a kilogram, but for pieces of memory for our people. And we don't have these ephemera extant anymore. So we're told in an unusual Hebrew formulation that his bedstand was one cubit, one arm length, by the arm length of a person. In a way, be'amot ve'amat ish, a personal measurement, which is a little vague. But the Rashbam, writing in parts of France in the roughly the 12th century, they're described, he says to you, it was actually his crib. He was already so strong at that era that when he was still quite young, when he stretched out in his bed, the frame would collapse. And as a result, they made an iron bedstead for him. It was preserved on the site where he had grown up in order for anyone seeing it to be amazed. Like Lincoln's home. You know, like, that's what I'm reminded of is, you know, you can go to see George Washington's youth home. I don't know what they understood this to be. And we don't have reference. We don't have, it doesn't still exist if it ever did. But the struggle that's presented in the original Hebrew, in the Hebrew of Deuteronomy 3:11, is what's meant by an arm length, a cubit, of man-sized. It's some reference to it being of an extraordinary measure. We have evidence about silver as well, that there were different scales. And so when you would negotiate, not only did you say how many pieces of silver, but according to which measurement scale. That seems to be what's in mind in this verse. So Ibn Ezra, writing in roughly the same time as Rashbam, the previous person I cited, but across the Pyrenees in Spain, states what really they're telling you, it was just double-sized, that their measurement was double to our size. Because כי מה בא הכתוב ללמד עוד שלא יהיה בצלם אדם כלל? Because there is an inference one could make that Og's bedstead was measured according to his arm length, which becomes a nonsensical way to describe length, right? Like if you're saying he was as tall as his arm length, well, of course, this measurement would correspond to my arm as well, right? Like you can't measure a thing with reference to itself. And such would imply that he was not at all like a human being. He was some extraordinary being, not human at all. So Ibn Ezra tells us that what's only indicated is that it was large. And this largeness, this improbable stature of those we would face in ancient Israel at the crossing of the Jordan is indicated several chapters ago in the stories of the spies who described themselves as feeling grasshoppers to the giants of the land. We looked as grasshoppers in our own eyes. What this begins to suggest to me is the human phenomenon of understanding ourselves through language that we construct. That we envision ourselves, that nothing is necessarily firm, permanent, or objective, but some amount of reality is constructed through the self. And most things, many things, are subjective and comparative rather than absolute and objective. And our mind, through the avenue of thought and language, can play tricks on us, that we can become dumbfounded by things we perceive as larger than us, people we perceive as more successful than we, people we perceive as more joyful than we. A wonderful piece of my work in the early years was to realize that no one is as happy as they seem on the outside. That no one is as happy in my office talking to me as they are in the hallway outside. Every human being has struggles and valleys and darkness, fear and sadness. And so we construct the world around us for good or ill through language, through perception. And we see this again, Moses, in recapitulating a bit the story of the spies, tells us that these scouts saw great and fortified cities. And as I'm indicating from the beginning, I don't think our ancestors were naive about literary constructs. I don't think they were unaware of hyperbole. I don't think they misunderstood metaphor. Because Rashi says, scriptural texts sometimes speak in exaggerated terms, lishon hava'i. It's not so clear what that etymology is. The language of orientation, maybe, is how you'd speak. Idiom is what he's saying, but the commentators on his own work make a really beautiful point. That lashon hava'i, this idiomatic speech, for lack of a better English translation, is a common person's manner of speech. And I talked about this with the board. It's the idea of not being precise with your words and saying things that are not true. Different to lying unintentionally, just being imprecise. And think of the many ways in which we are imprecise with ourselves and our world, to our detriment, to the detriment of others. We talk in broad scope, but don't recognize unique difference. We address ourselves without being aware of our full capacities because we speak in generalizations. I'm a bad cook. I'm not tall. I'm terrible at basketball. I didn't succeed in my career. Without recognizing that we're overwhelming ourselves with language in a way. And the capacity of a person, not just through language, but through all mental schema, to paralyze oneself and to impair oneself is unparalleled. So now we get to my map and a beautiful verse that I have never understood. So in the middle of Moses' speech, to address the people. He's about a chapter and a half into Deuteronomy, which is his valedictory speech, I'll often say. He just pauses and says, get up and cross Wadi Zered. A place I don't think is mentioned prior to that line. So maybe if you were a biblical scientist or scholar, you would say, oh, that text of the original story of crossing Wadi Zered was lost to us, and it's only preserved in Deuteronomy. So I got to look up, what is Wadi Zered? What do we understand it to be? And in Arabic, it's known as Wadi al-Hasa. It's in Jordan. This would be the Dead Sea. And this is Jordan. And I think those are the Edomite and the Moabite mountains. So the concept is that they had sort of ascended into the highlands to the east of Jordan and paused at some riverbed, encamped there, and kind of were assessing their strategy. And conceptually, what's being said is they got paralyzed. We can sit at a riverbed thinking about all the ways to cross it. We can look at our career choices or our parenting choices or our choices in retirement and think about all the things we could do, all the different strategies and avenues to take, and just get stuck. Stuck because the things we conceive on the opposite side of that riverbed, on the opposite side of that Rubicon, seem too awesome to us, seem too improbable and unfathomable. So they needed a kick in the pants, and that's what he's saying to them. So Midrash says, what's really hysterical, Midrash says that the Wadi was just about this wide. It wasn't some enormous river. It was just a spot that they got stuck. It wasn't a challenge of fording a great river. It was just that they couldn't figure out what the next step was. And we often forget in the book of Numbers, the people didn't wander the Sinai Peninsula for 40 years. They wandered for about 18 months, and then they did nothing for 38 years. God said, put them in a holding pattern. Because everyone will say, like, how can you wander such a small area for 40 years? That makes no sense. That's clearly hyperbole or stupidity. No, they wandered it for a somewhat reason. They were camping and traveling and backpacking for a reasonable amount of time and then stopped for decades. Rashi puts in Moses' mouth this idea, you know, to a certain place in Kadesh Barnea, you got there quicker than you could imagine, and to cross the river, to cross the Jordan and cross into the land took you infinitely longer than it ought to have. We look at the crossings in our lives, we look at the rivers and the things on the other side, and the ways in which we see them and define them and describe them to ourselves and to others can either impair us or encourage us. And at all those forks in the road, the way we orient our own perception is sometimes what matters an awful lot. What do you see on the other side, and how do you explain it to yourself? Is it with fear or excitement? And sometimes, my wife is very good at this, you need a kick in the pants. You've had long enough in the pity party. You've had long enough sitting at the side of the wadi. You've had long enough staring at the bedstead of a giant. You've had long enough debating about what to do, and you just need to take the next step. So we have this idea of chalutzim, the pioneers in modern Zionist history, we call them chalutzim, but really they're probably shock troops. They're probably the vanguard of an army. And sometimes we need to be pioneers and tread and cross dried riverbeds and not be afraid and take bold new steps and sometimes make corrective action once we do. But at many points in life, paralysis is the worst. And we need loved ones and our own heart to kick us and tell us up, cross Wadi Zered.